I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
We're going to take our case as far as it needs to go, including all the way up to the Supreme Court. And let me tell you something. I think we ought to go back to the first one and go all the way, which is what I wanted to do in the first place.
President Trump reacts to the courts blocking his travel ban on Muslim-majority countries back in March 2017. Well, the president gets his wish. Today, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments on his travel ban. The ban is now in its third version as the administration has worked to get around various legal challenges. In its current form, the travel ban bars most people from five predominantly Muslim countries: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. It also includes North Korea and some government officials from Venezuela. But to understand the travel ban, you have to go back to late 2015. Here was candidate Donald Trump campaigning in December of that year.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Trump v. Hawaii is before the justices today. Faiza Patel is co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, which filed an amicus brief against the ban. Faiza, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, Faiza, that statement from Donald Trump when he was a candidate, December 2015, it gets played all the time. How important is that statement to the case today and the president's intent when he signed the executive order instituting the travel ban?
It's actually critical to the case. The case argues that the point of the ban was to ban Muslims from coming into the United States, and the government has argued, no, that's not the point. The point was a national security purpose, and it goes to showing the intent behind the ban. So it's that first statement that you just played back from December 2015, but then ongoing statements that Trump has made while he was a candidate and then continuing to make during the time that he's been president as well.
Now, what does the government say to this claim? I mean, the statements are clear. They are what they are. But does the government say that despite the statements of candidate Trump, many Muslim countries aren't under the travel ban? So how could this be a religious ban?
Yeah, I mean, the government argues many things. Its primary argument is that this is an exercise of the president's national security and foreign relations discretion, and so the courts really just shouldn't be going behind what's written in the executive order. They also point out that obviously not all Muslims are covered by this ban. Nonetheless, the fact that the ban was premised on the idea that Muslims should be kept out of the country, I don't think really takes away from its discriminatory intent and impact.
So, Faiza, the ban has changed. It's been through several iterations since the first one, January 27th of 2017, at the beginning of the Trump presidency. Can you describe how it's changed, how it's narrowed to get to the point today so that the ban that's in front of the court is the one that justices are dealing with?
Sure. The very first ban was very expansive, and it applied not just to people traveling to the United States from other countries, but also to permanent residents of the United States. It also included language which made it clear that it didn't include Christians from these countries under the ban. The second iteration of the ban was a little narrower in that it took away this preference for Christians from the countries named in the ban, and also exempted green card holders from the ban. Nonetheless, it also focused on Muslim countries. The third iteration, which came out in the fall of last year, took a slightly different tack in that it justified the ban on the grounds that we simply didn't have enough cooperation and information from the countries named in the ban to allow citizens from there to come into the United States.
Now, Justice Neil Gorsuch is relatively new on the court, Faiza, but do you see anything in the historical opinions, the voting patterns, or the decisions of the liberals and the conservatives on the court that point you to how justices may rule here?
Well, you know, traditionally, when cases go to the Supreme Court, everybody watches what Justice Kennedy is going to do. And I think that that's, again, going to be very critical over here, how he views the ban. I also think that, you know, if the justices are prepared to look with any degree of care at this ban, that they're going to find it unconstitutional or illegal under the Immigration and Nationality Act. The question really is, how closely are the justices going to look, or are they going to buy the government's argument that, you know, this is a national security matter and you just really shouldn't be interfering?
Realistically, what are you looking for from the court here? A complete strike down, or more realistically, some sort of slapback, some sort of limitation on the Trump administration's ability to enact this ban here?
So I think it's important to remember that the procedural posture of this case, so the ban hasn't actually been litigated on the merits ever. The courts have issued what's called a preliminary injunction stopping the ban from going into effect. But the Supreme Court has allowed the ban to go forward while it considers this case. So the ban is currently in effect. Now, the court is going to be ruling on whether or not to uphold the preliminary injunction. I think what people challenging the ban, like myself, hope for is the court will say, yes, this preliminary injunction should be upheld because the plaintiffs have demonstrated that they're likely to succeed on the merits of the claim. At that point, I think it's very difficult for the government to go back and recraft the ban because they will have lost over three iterations of the ban. I mean, so I think that's a very good outcome for people. Alternatively, the court can decide, well, no, this preliminary injunction wasn't justified, either because they find that there's no likelihood of success on the merits or because they find some other equitable reason for allowing this to go forward. So in that case, the case would technically go back down to the lower courts, although I think it becomes very challenging for those of us who oppose the ban at that point. A third possibility, which I think is unlikely but could happen, is that if the court has a difficult time coming to agreement on this, then they could sort of find a way to split the baby, if you will, and potentially send this case back down to the lower courts for them to develop a more extensive factual record, for example. So there are three possibilities on the table. I think the third one's, as a practical matter, probably pretty unlikely. So I think we're looking probably at one of the first two.
Faiza Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, since last January, the various versions of the travel ban have changed how millions of people come and go from the United States. Like Tara Separi-Farr, she came to the U.S. as a student from Iran in 2010. She's now a researcher at Human Rights Watch, but at the time of the first travel ban, she was a green card holder.
We were expecting some version of the travel ban, but the version that was first communicated was extremely broad and brief, in a sense that there was no clarity in what exactly it excludes and what doesn't. And for me, I was in the middle of planning another trip to the UK to participate in a conference, and all of a sudden started hearing from the news that I might not be able to come back to the country where I now call home if I leave the country for my work trip. And that started to hurt because I came here now some 8 years ago. And because of the kind of work I do and my background of activism, I don't go back to my home country. I can't. It's actually risky for me to go back, and I will be subjected to harassment. And so I have nowhere else to go. It was later clarified that green card holders were not subjected to the law. So ultimately, I could travel, but for a short period, we actually were instructed by our organization just not to travel because it was too risky and no one wanted to figure out how to get us out of airport detention centers or anything like that.
Now, the travel ban, of course, has been winding its way through the courts ever since. Lots of challenges. Tara, what about your family? You have family in Iran who I guess you haven't seen in quite a while. Are they able to travel to the U.S.? Have they tried?
As I mentioned, because I don't travel to Iran at the moment, I have to see my family somewhere else. And the ideal would be for them to come here so I can host them. And my parents applied for a tourist visa in March 2017 because my partner and I were planning to get married here in the United States. But my parents were still refused the visa, which actually made us change our plans. And to this day, they have not reapplied because even if they apply under the newest version of the travel ban, the standard is very high and you basically have to provide documentation why they should be exempted from this blanket ban that is still in place for many nationalities.
So Tara, what are you looking for from the Supreme Court today and in the coming months as they deliberate? Are you looking for the court to do away with the travel ban entirely, or do you think it's appropriate to have some level of increased security from some countries, but that it needs to be fair?
I totally understand the broad power the president has in terms of setting regulation in matters related to immigration policy. And I also totally understand that there are legitimate risks that any country should take into account when they're trying to secure their borders. But I think the problem with the travel ban, and I think the implementation of the different phases of travel ban speaks for itself, is the discriminatory intent and the lack of clear objectives in what exactly they are trying to prevent, other than broadly labeling people based on their national origin as threat to national security. I don't think it does any good, or it doesn't send any positive message to people inside Iran that I know the U.S. administration has been talking about caring about them. I don't think that's the kind of message that would be well received at home either.
Tara Separi-Farr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tara Separi-Farr is an Iranian-American, a researcher at Human Rights Watch.